It's episode 81. At some point, the shift is coming to the new podcast, and while it's a while off, I just want to prepare you for that at some point. We left off last week with a bit about the difference in culture from my experience in the Air Force and the FDIC. I realize a military organization is very different overall, and the FDIC is a relatively small organization in comparison. The total strength was easily only one-third of the size of an average-sized Air Force base. Although with the regional and field offices, it had some similar qualities associated with intermediate and top-level leadership. One of the things that landed on my desk, aside from those piles of paperwork, was a magazine called CLO Magazine. It was a professional publication for chief learning officers, and there were copies throughout the university. My thought was, how does one get on the cover? Oh well, one can wonder. I did get to meet some of the profiled CLOs at the conferences and board meetings that I was asked to participate in. It was through these programs that I learned about two very valuable organizations that we eventually partnered with. And before I go on, I feel that even though this was more than a decade ago, mentioning these organizations is not an endorsement of their products or programs, and I'm simply sharing the experience that we had at the FDIC. The first was Pacific Institute. I was familiar with this program from my time at NDU and knew it could further the work at the FDIC. I decided to see how this would benefit the FDIC in a little bit of a different way. And it's really about goal setting, using affirmations, and how to see things in a different way. The founder still taught much of the program and included CDs, yes, from then CDs, to refresh your experience. I still use aspects of this in my own life, and let me just give you two examples of parts of this program. The first is how your conscious and subconscious work. They must match, or there is a conflict that you have to either take action to shift or resign to the subconscious. And the example is this. Let's say someone throws a rock through your window, and you're upset. You see the rock. You see the broken glass, and you see how your spouse touched up the hole. Your subconscious says, that's not normal. Your conscious sees the reality of the incident. And your spouse says, I've called the repair folks, and they'll be here next week. Okay, that's good. The next day you come home, and you see the taped up window, shake your head and think, well, it's going to be fixed soon. Your subconscious still says, that's not normal. And over the next couple of days, you barely notice the window and it becomes the new normal. Your subconscious and conscious are matched up once again. Even when it's repaired, your subconscious says, well, that's different. And your conscious says, yes, because now it's back to the old normal. Here's another example that I'm sure everyone has experienced. Let's say you're buying a new modem because, well, yours broke, or you just want to get a new modem. You get the Sunday paper or go online, and everywhere you look, there are modems, and they're on sale. Your conscious says you need a new modem. Your subconscious looks for ways to resolve the conflict. Now, these ads are there every day. You just don't see them because you don't have a need to see them. It's like when you buy a new car. You buy a new shiny car and you're driving it down the road, and all of a sudden, you see many models that you purchased. This is your subconscious telling you that you made a good decision because look, so many others made the same decision that you did. And that helps ease that initial phase where you have that buyer's remorse that maybe that wasn't the best car to buy. Let's look at a more goal-oriented example. Let's say you're considering getting a promotion or want to change careers. Your subconscious says, no, you pick the title. And your conscious says, Your goal is to be, say, vice president. You see advertisements for courses in the new area. You see ads for positions in the new area. Maybe you don't even have a car, and you see an ad on TV that talks about ride sharing or how improved the public transportation system is. There is a real life example. There was a woman who took this program years and years ago. She was an African-American woman who worked at a telecom company at an entry-level job, and she definitely wanted to advance. At the time that she was in that position, advancement for her was going to be a tough road. She used that program and let her subconscious marry with her conscious. And when I met her, she was the vice president of that corporation. Now, all of this is a condensed version of these parts of the program, and we integrated aspects of them into our leadership program and electives program, and they were some of the most requested courses because, as I mentioned last week, people want to learn, and they want programs that will help them professionally and personally. The other firm is called Fierce. This is a great program, and maybe in some ways we liked it more than Pacific Institute. Fierce was a program that focused on how to better communicate with those around you and be fierce with yourself. It's a great program, and we integrated all the aspects into our leadership programs at the various levels. Three of us became Fierce qualified trainers, and I got to know the Fierce leadership as we moved forward using their program and materials. I've used a couple parts of their program when I talked about emptying your backpack early in this podcast, meaning you don't carry around all those issues and unsaid conversations. And many conversations are difficult, whether work or home. I think especially for me, the course was beneficial to navigate both with my peers and internal team members. The downside, well, maybe not really downside, was that unlike Pacific Institute, for every person that we trained, we had to buy the materials from Fierce. The plus is that the individuals kept the materials so they could refer back to them, including a desk reference to how to have those Fierce conversations. Because not having those conversations, as many of you have experienced, is why there is conflict in an organization. It's important to take those rocks out of your backpack. We all know that changing culture in any organization is a challenge. When I took the job at the FDIC, one of the things that they wanted me to do was affect change in the culture because they knew there needed to be some improvements. It's really a challenge that is daunting. There are so many long-term employees with long memories, and that makes it difficult. Combine that with the change in how we hired new examiners and resolutions employees at the corporate level instead of being hired at the field office level, and most of them were right out of college, and the integration of millennials into the organization added to this challenge. And this is where Fierce was beneficial to help with the conversations as they came about. And if both sides, newer employees and more experienced management, understand the programs that you're using, then the conversations come about a lot more easily. Before this, all of our programs were developed in-house for leadership. And with the integration of these two programs, in hindsight, it was both unique ways for us to move forward. I also think that by using program materials that weren't necessarily FDIC developed, they helped brand the university and brand the leadership program with increased credibility. We also did two things to help build our team, and they may seem small, they will have a big impact on an organization. The first was a CU lapel pin. It was an oval lapel pin with the CU logo on it. That's it. The business lines had pins for their employees. We were the only support organization that decided to also have a pin for our division. Some of our employees came from the business lines, and they stopped wearing the business line pin and wore the CU pin, which shows that they were transitioning their mindset from being a business line employee to one learning and development. The other thing that we did was developed a corporate university coin. The only other officer who had a coin was the chairman. And so we used both to recognize and reward inside and outside of the division. Since I was a corporate officer, I could also hand out the chairman's coin on her behalf. Our coin was well received because, similarly to what we did at Malmstrom, it was created with line employee input. We are continuing to be busy, and 18 to 24 months was in many ways a blur because of the financial crisis. Before we knew it, we were having meetings thinking about when and how to cut the temporary regional offices and return the employee base back to a more normalized posture. As I thought about this, I had some ideas on how corporate university could help with this process, as well as maintaining the emphasis and learning for the top of the organization, because it's typically 12 to 15 years between banking crises. And for line employees, you may recall that the director of resolutions wanted the Dallas Learning Center to develop the recurring training program for employees to keep them current, as well as creating non-existent career progression ladders across what I recall were three main areas of the division's workforce. My experience with doing that on the air staff came back, and we essentially used some similar processes. The employees from the business line were amazing in helping move this forward because they were long-term employees who understood why the career progression was important for the long-term success of the division. In addition to all the travel that I was doing with the FDIC, going to the temporary offices, regional offices, field offices, I was also expending my own personal travel. A nice benefit of the travel with the FDIC was that I was in Dallas at the Dallas Learning Center at least on a monthly basis. And with my friends that were not too far from Dallas, I got to both renew and enjoy time together. In addition, with the stand-up of the office in Jacksonville, I had a friend who I also got to see on a fairly regular basis as well. You know, sometimes things just work out. My personal travel was also shifting to more international destinations that stemmed in large measure from my time at NDU. We're getting to the point in the podcast where there's going to be some shifting and some fast-forwarding because so many experiences in my life were happening all at once. So I'll try to do it in some semblance of order, I guess, if that's the best word. Initially, I traveled with friends, and that worked nicely. And after I retired, I realized that others worked. And so that's when I started to do a lot more traveling by myself. My friend Alvain was from South Africa, and I traveled there a couple of times, and it was amazing. Not only going to Africa, it was the farthest point away in Africa. It's such a different part of the world, and yet I want to share them with you, and I'll do that in a future episode, because just traveling to Africa would fill multiple episodes. When the pandemic halted travel, I do think about it, and there are places that I still want to go. At the same time, now coming up being 5 years older makes the amount of travel I did seem unrealistic. And I hope that I can get out there a bit, maybe even some more this year. Let me share a trip that I took about 9 years ago with some friends to Lisbon, Portugal. We were supposed to go to Sweden, and I don't remember how, but we switched up going to Lisbon, and I had never been there, so fine with me. Lisbon is an amazing city. It is one of the best trips that I've made. There is the old side and the new side, almost two completely different cities. The wine is amazing. We traveled to Sintra to the palace, and there are lots to share from this trip. What I want to talk about are the three tours. One was a walking tour, one was that private wine tour to Sintra, and one was the Seven Hills tour. So I'm sure you've guessed, Lisbon is quite hilly. Each of the tours were amazing and done very well, and we learned a lot. I want to talk, though, about the Seven Hills tour. The Seven Hills tour takes you all through Lisbon. The hills are steep as you go all over the city. Now, we knew the tour was on bikes, and since I was an avid bike rider, I was fine with that. After all, I live in Arlington, Virginia, and for those who are familiar with Arlington, the Roslyn Hill is a real challenge, so I was ready. We got to the tour site, and it's on electric bikes. At this time, I was driving a Cannondale Synapse 3. It weighed 9.5 pounds and was super fast. I had not ever been on an electric bike. These were well over 50 pounds because they were the cheaper end bikes for a tour company. And I'm kind of freaking out because I just didn't know how this was going to go. If you saw me on ATVs in Costa Rica, you'd understand. Anyway, it takes some getting used to, and I have a problem with the bike. And my friends were not too kind in a somewhat fun way. Finally, the tour guide checked out my bike, and he figured out the problem was that the battery on my bike was failing. So he gave me his bike, and he took mine. The tour guide took the rest of the tour with no motor, and pushing a heavy bike up those hills is a challenge, and he zipped up them as fast as we did on the electric bikes. Remember, when you're biking, you're pushing your own body weight and the weight of the bike along with you. I'm going to give you a quick example, and I learned this from a bike store when I was thinking of buying, I can't remember what it was, but there was a difference in the weight between the two ideas. And he said, take a soup can, just a small soup can, and rotate it several times with your arm. And do that as many times as you can. And if you do it with a lighter can, you'll see the difference. And that's what you're doing on a bike. Every revolution, you're moving the weight of the bike and the weight of you. So between a 9.5 pound bike and a 50 plus pound bike is a huge difference, especially when you're going up a hill. The trip was amazing, and learning how to ride an electric bike was not that difficult. And yet at the same time, it was that trip that I decided to buy an electric bike. I didn't buy the electric bike for some years after this trip to Lisbon, and it was actually after I had shoulder surgery that I decided it was time to get the electric bike because I knew it would be more stable than a road bike. I did a lot of research, and my friends in Texas already had electric bikes, and they had ones that folded up so they could take them wherever they wanted to go biking. I still had the Mini Cooper Coupe, so that sounded like a good idea, and I looked around. What I learned was that the ones that I liked were made outside the United States, and even the bike dealership said they didn't recommend it because getting parts was difficult. I appreciated his honesty, and I had already ridden Trex and Giants and my Cannondale, so I liked the Cannondale most, and I went to the Cannondale dealership. They had just started with the new idea of selling an e-bike. It was only 45 pounds, and it came with features that I definitely wanted included, like fenders and a rack on the back. Of course, a good lighting system, because I would likely be riding sometimes at night, and I wanted a quality battery and motor because I had done some research about that as well. This one had a Bosch turbo motor with a higher capacity battery. All of these things made me think this is the bike for me. Oh, it also had an integrated lock. And so I got to talking with the owner for some time, and he not only gave me a military discount, he gave me an additional discount if I bought the bike. And so I did. Now, if you're considering an e-bike, they're now much more popular than when I bought my bike about, it might be 7 or maybe now 6 years ago that I bought my bike. And even the rental bikes around the city have e-bikes as an option because they really are growing in popularity. Here's the thing about e-bikes. E-bikes have a rating, class 1, 2, or 3. Class 1 bikes are rated for 20 miles per hour and requires the rider to pedal to activate the motor. Class 2 bikes are also rated for 20 miles per hour, but do not require the rider to pedal. It's basically more like a bike-style moped that goes 20 miles an hour. Class 3 bikes are rated at 28 miles per hour and requires the rider to also pedal the bike. Mine is a Class 3, and I was also very happy about that because it would go faster, also because of the turbo. It had one additional setting. So I'll tell you that I've gotten that bike to 45 miles an hour many times, and it's really quite a good bike because it is a Bosch. I've rented e-bikes twice when I was visiting friends in Nevada, and while I did have a pretty nice bike, they weren't nearly as powerful as mine. The biggest observation still, and I do bike a lot, in fact, I bike more miles a year than I drive my vehicle. And going from a 9.5-pound road bike to a 45-pound electric bike is a big difference, as I mentioned earlier. And what I kind of figured out was, if you have the setting for the motor on the second one, and you have the gear in probably the second or third one, it's about negates the weight of the bike, because... And if you're wondering, well, how far can you go on an e-bike? Well, if you're on the lowest level, I can go about 60 miles. On the higher level, which I'm in a lot, you can maybe go about 30 miles. And the unique thing is that it comes with a charger that if you put it in your backpack or on your bike rack and take it with you, you can take it someplace where maybe the Starbucks, and you can plug it in, and you only need about 10 minutes, and that'll probably give you enough battery power to get home. The other thing about e-bikes is that people think that it's not exercise, when in fact it's at or more because, again, you're powering yourself and the bike. And while it's assist, if you will, you're still doing a lot of work. I'm often comparing how I was, the effort I was exerting when I was on my road bike after a trip or a ride, and how it is on the e-bike. Now, I'm moving pretty fast, so if you're more leisurely, it's going to be less work. However, you're still moving your legs, and you are getting aerobic exercise. There are other advantages as well. It's far more stable, as I mentioned, because of the weight and the wider tires. You don't have to worry about being seen as much because the front and rear lights are powered by the battery, and the battery is removable if you don't want to leave it with the bike, although it does lock onto the bike with a key. The best part of the electric bike is that if you have a flat or emergency when out and about, the tires are actually easier to change, and I don't remember why, and they did tell me, but my memory is not as good as it used to be. Anyway, having done it, it is easier. On the negative side, the maintenance is more. Keeping the chain clean is more important, and tabs on the brakes, because they do wear faster due to the weight and the speed, and I've had mine replaced already. When I got my e-bike, it was the first model of an e-bike that Cannondale made. Since then, progress has been made, and they sell several models now. And I had to replace my chain, for example, and now they replaced it with an e-bike-specific component. And there are more components that are designed to last longer because of the differences between e-bikes and regular bikes. If you're considering an e-bike, I highly recommend them. For me, it was my physical issues, and I'm biking far more than I would if I was still riding the road bike. We're at the end of the episode, and we'll go backwards again because there is a cycling event that was really amazing that I did on my road bike, and I'll share that next week. This was an exciting week on another front. Now, you've all met my mom through the many early episodes of the podcast, and we've just finalized and signed the Barbara Holton Terwilliger Endowed Research Fund in Veterinary Medicine at the University of Maryland College Park in her honor. This new endowment will further animal research, and you can go to the University of Maryland College Park website in a couple of weeks and search for Terwilliger to support this research. One of the more famous research outcomes of the lab was the COVID vaccine for dogs. It's quite an accomplished research outfit, and I'm really happy that I was able to do this. It's something I've wanted to do for many, many years, and it was just difficult to find the right place that I wanted to have her name on this research. Have fun out there. Be safe. I forgot if I shared that I took my bonsai trees out of the refrigerator after their 1,000 hours of forced winter. And just after a month, almost all of them are leafing out. So spring has sprung, at least in Kona's penthouse. Bonsai is also a really fun thing to do. Have a wonderful week, and thank you for continuing to join me in the podcast.